My name is Andreas Hitterstad. I'm a socialist, I'm a Marxist. I agree very much with the last quote from Marx and so on. But I'm going to talk about my chapter pretty much in the capacity that I've written it. And I'm also the deputy leader of something called the Concerned Scientist Norway, which is an organization of around 200 people who is part of an organization because they're concerned about climate change. And that concern really, really overwhelms me. You know, Richard was talking about the perfect moral storm. I don't know, I haven't read the news this morning, but the perfect hurricane apparently hit Mexico last night, showing that the urgency of what we're talking about is very, very fundamental. And I want to stress that from the very outset here, because I'm very happy to be invited here, both because it's a left forum and it's a discussion among socialists, but also because Teppo tells me that there are people here who knows about the climate movement in Finland. I'm very interested in listening to what you're doing. I don't know how things are in Finland, but I can tell you in Norway there's momentum building. There's momentum building to the Paris summit that is coming up now in November and December. So what I'm going to do here is that I'm going to talk about the chapter in my book, but I'm going to talk a little bit around it. Also because my chapter is really a taking note of a developing climate movement in Norway and internationally. So I'm happy to answer questions, you know, on more on the chapter, but I want to do this also as a kind of a build-up to the dialogue that we're going to have afterwards with Rickard and with all you guys here as well. Just give you an idea of the momentum and the task ahead. Last week, the biggest single paper in Norway, called Aftenposten, held its own climate conference, in itself an unprecedented thing. I think Aftenbladet had done the same thing in Sweden. At least it was an idea picked up from Aftenbladet. But anyway, 1,400 people appeared in a theater in Oslo. We had James Hansen, the world's most famous climate scientist there. We had Cristina Figueres, the UN climate chief, leading the negotiations up to Paris there, and ministers, and, you know, polar expeditionists, and, you know, bloggers, and everybody. You know, it was, you know, a big thing. And Cristina Figueres, who is the climate negotiation boss, she said that, well, I am the daughter of a revolutionary, so I'm not afraid at all of the word revolution. And there's no doubt that there is a need for a revolution in order to avert climate change. And I think that this has to be a starting point. I mean, go to any airport, big airport in the world, and I dare you not to find a commercial talking about revolution. So the idea of revolution and the word of revolution is oftentimes used. And remember the statistics here. Global emissions are going up on a yearly basis by something like 3%. They need to come down by 3% annually. And in the rich countries like Norway, Finland, they need to go down between 5 and 10%. And it needs to be very, very rapidly. So just to bend those curves, it's completely natural to talk about revolution. You have to bend the curves, and it's a revolution. But the strange thing about what Cristina Figueres was talking about when she mentioned revolution, that she's the daughter of revolution, that this revolution probably is the first revolution in human history where people are not mentioned at all. Well, there's no attempt, and this is my biggest frustration as a concerned scientist. We have this overwhelming challenge, and we have this overwhelming talk of our biggest challenge. And we even have the talk of revolution, but there's no strategy. There's not even an attempt to involve people in that revolution. I mean, we have revolution, the French Revolution, we have loads of revolutions, and we remember them for people being involved. But what is the revolution that we're talking about now? It's either a technical revolution, it's a revolution of entrepreneurship, but it never seems to involve people. And that's a big worry for me. But it's a good thing that it's a mobilization going on. And I think one of the key challenges that we face is to distinguish between the momentum building from above. I mean, Obama is talking about climate change. You know, all the state leaders, I'm sure in Finland here as well, you will have people talking in big words about climate change. But what is really happening in the build-up to Paris? I attended, together with representatives of Norwegian civil society, the Norwegian negotiation delegation for Paris last Friday. It was a kind of meeting about this size, you know, experts, really good negotiators. If there was a world championships in negotiating, Norway would be very good. They were very, very good negotiators. They know all about emissions. They know all about processes. And also, experts in civil society, Friends of the Earth, you know, the trade unions were there, the bosses' organizations was there. And what was the message coming from the Norwegian negotiating team? Well, for the first time, it's like more than 150 countries of the world have pledged emission cuts for the upcoming Paris. And it was put forward as a big, big step forward. And what did those pledges amount to? And remember, these are just voluntary pledges. There's absolutely no compliance regime. There's no sanctions. There's no airstrikes on countries not complying with climate change regimes. You know, Canada pulled out of Kyoto, nothing happened. So, but even given those voluntary emissions, what does it amount to? Well, there's a report apparently coming up in the next couple of weeks which is going to give the exact number. But what they've pledged so far is a world between 2.7 degrees warmer and 2.9 degrees warmer than we have at the moment. And the message from the Norwegian negotiation team was, this is good. Of course, if you want to preserve the 2-degree target, you know, then you can just write your press release immediately, because it's bad. But if you look at it from the perspective of a negotiating process going forward, this is a big, big step forward. Basically, we were being asked as civil society to celebrate the baby steps of diplomacy rather than the complete failure of meeting this climate change challenge. So in this context, for me, it's very important to say that one of Marx's quotes that really rings to mind, and it's probably borrowed from Hegel, it is not enough with the power of argument. You need the argument of power as well. I'm sure within the next decade or two, there's going to be a whole number of people after we've really screwed things up who said, I told you so, I had the right arguments on paper all along. Bloggers, scientists, politicians, they're all going to tell us. I'm not joking about this. In the book that I participated in, there's some really, really good ideas. Some of the best ideas of what we could do comes from the political left. So this book is a very good one. All of the chapters, I think, fit very much into that. But I think we're faced with the challenge of everybody seeing, can we make those powerful ideas relate to some kind of social and political power that can make that transformation happen? And that's why I think the important question to ask is not how much are we going to cut emissions, you know, but really what sort of ideas have the potential to move masses and masses of people to make the transformation happen? And that is, to me, part of the answer to that is the idea of climate jobs. Now, climate jobs is also just an argument. It's like any argument. So here's the argument first. The argument is, one of the most powerful defenses that our rulers have today is to say that we cannot take care of the future because there are more pressing needs now. And among those pressing needs is obviously, you know, food, the basic stuff we need, but most of all, jobs. Because jobs in the capitalist system is how we can pay for our food, how we can pay for our housing. And austerity-ridden, you know, Europe and in many other parts of the country, part of the world, people will not choose the global climate above their job, their interest right now. So the idea of climate jobs is to fight for those jobs that gets emissions down. That's the simplicity of it. In order to get emissions down by 80% or 90% in the next 15 to 20 years, we need millions and millions of jobs all across the world in renewable energy, in housing, in transport, obviously in agriculture and other areas as well, but majorly those three areas: renewable energy, transport, and housing. And we need to fight for those jobs. And if we can fight for good, solid jobs that at the same time contribute to do something about climate change, then that might be a good argument that also connects to power. So I want to tell you a little bit about how things have developed in Norway, because I think that although you might argue it's still just an argument, more or less appealing, you might like it, I guess in this room you'd like it, you know. But the great and interesting thing in Norway that it has begun to have a certain power. Not power in the sense that would actually change much. I must admit that straight away. But power in the sense that it has begun to be taken aboard by many different groups in society. So, what happened in Norway? In 2013, I wrote a book called 100,000 Climate Jobs. And that book was not just my book. It was endorsed by three national unions, most of the environmental organizations in Norway, and the Norwegian Church. And we now talk about the trinity of church organizations, environmental organizations, and a growing portion of labor unions. In the latest book, called Bridge to the Future, which I edited and which came out now in August, which with 17 chapters, there's chapters by four leaders of national trade union leaders, there's bishops participating, there's Sharon Barrow, who's the leader of the International Trade Union Confederation, representing 176 million workers outside, who's written the first chapter in the book. There's chapters on jobs in agriculture and fishing and so on. That campaign for 100,000 climate jobs, only the day before yesterday, Greenpeace Norway launched its campaign up to Paris for 100,000 new green jobs as their campaign. This fall, there's something called the Norwegian Organization for Children and for Youth and Children Organization, called LNU. There's 90 organizations, most of the voluntary NGOs participating. They have one campaign to step into the new renewable age, and it's called the Fight for Climate Jobs. Afterwards, if you have time, I can show you the website of Brundtland. You will see they made videos. They made this phony environmental and knowledge minister interviewing me and other people for the jobs necessary. But it's basically also 100,000 climate jobs put at the forefront. Now, the climate jobs issue is not the only issue. And we've had two national conferences in Norway. First, in 2014, we were 350 people. Then in 2015, this year, we were more than 500 people in the trade union main locale in Oslo. We also include issues like climate justice and the fact that we've kind of become a trinity. We're trying to get some of the peasant organizations with us as well, means that we take aboard other issues. We try to be inclusive. So we have climate jobs, and this is my interpretation. Climate jobs, the demand for 100,000 new climate jobs in Norway is, you know, speaking of Naomi Klein, is the leap. That's the leap demand. In Naomi Klein's book, is structured around the idea of leap years. We had just a few years left in order to make those big leaps that can get emissions down. And the demand for 100,000 climate jobs is, in the Norwegian case, a leap demand. But it needs to build and build on other things as well. The fight for a just transition within the trade union movement has been going on for many years, and that's something that we've included much more. The need to green existing workplaces to make it more environmentally friendly is also something that we need to be including. And we need to include the north-south perspective, because people in the global south, like in Mexico, are suffering much, much more out of climate change than we do. So we need to include those things, but we have to put this demand that we have these jobs that bring emissions down as a focal point. And I think it has been a pretty good start that we've had. Theoretically, I think you can speak of this as Marx and Keynes in the same campaign. And it's, in that sense, it's very much in the spirit of the book that we're publishing here. Because what does it mean to create 100,000 climate jobs? Well, for the free marketeers and for neoliberals, they say, come on, you can't just say that you're going to have 100,000 climate jobs. You're going to have to let the market create those jobs. You're going to leave that for the dynamism and the flexibility and the entrepreneurship of the market. But both Keynesians and Marxists, social democrats and socialists, or anybody who understands the enormity of climate change, understands that you cannot leave climate change to the market. Wasn't it, in fact, Nicholas Stern, back in 2006, who called climate change the biggest market failure in history? So we cannot no longer trust those people who say, well, the king is dead, long live the king. The market didn't work, so what we'll do, we have no more market. We have to mobilize for political intervention into the economy. And that's obviously what unites social democrats and socialists, Keynesians and Marxists. And then we can have a discussion about how to go about it, how radical that transformation is. But that is the selling point. So one of the chapters in our latest book is an interview with Mariana Mazzucato, one of the leading economists of the world, arguing precisely that real innovation in this world, you know, the internet, things like that, did not happen just through market entrepreneurship. It happened through massive state intervention. So that's the kind of, those 100,000 jobs, we demand that of the government. It's not something that we say that, well, a few stimulus and a few green certificates in the market would take care of it. No, we need to have something more. Okay. Does this mean that we're winning? Not at all. I just said that the argument has gained some territory. How is that visible? Well, we had an election, a municipal election just this a month ago, where the Green Party in Norway made the biggest breakthrough ever, and there was also a shift to the left, both the radical left and the social democratic left at the same time. One of the key debates in the Norwegian election campaign, together with the refugee crisis, which Shura is going to talk about in the next session, was the idea of a green shift, that we have to shift Norway. Why? Because oil prices are very low in Norway at the moment. So Norway, that up until just 6 months ago, was fairly insulated from the crisis that has stricken the rest of Europe, the unemployment and the austerity of the rest of Europe, is now beginning to have the bite. You know, there are thousands of people in the oil industry have lost their jobs in Norway just over the last couple of months. So the idea that you have to transform, you have to transition, you have to have a green shift has hit the national agenda. And I think some of it is due to our campaign, to be honest. But, and there's a big, big but, the debate about the green shift in Norway at the moment is just about new jobs being created alongside of the fossil fuel industry. There's still no attempt at all to plan for an organized descent of Norwegian oil and gas. On the contrary, this year, the parliament said that we're going to drill for oil in the Arctic. And in the Arctic is the last place on Earth, if you want to have any chance of avoiding the worst cases of climate change, to open up for drilling in the Arctic is the last place. There was a big article in Nature early this year that said that for scientific reasons, for ethical reasons, for economic reasons even, you do not drill in the Arctic. Well, the Norwegian government has decided they are going to drill. They're going to use billions and billions of Norwegian kroners, and they're going to subsidize the oil industry to search for more oil and gas in there. So therefore, it has been very important for the Norwegian campaign to combine the demand for 100,000 new climate jobs with the demand that says put a brake on Norwegian oil. And that's what we're trying to do. We're having plans further. Okay. Does this amount to a power, something that we can have? Well, not on its own, but we have to think about the ideas that we discuss in this meeting within the context in which we're living, in what has happened the last year. In September 2014, Between 300,000 and 400,000 people demonstrated in New York in the biggest climate change demonstration, People Climate March in history. That People's Climate March is coming up on the 28th of November this year as well. In Paris, across the world, the People's Climate March, I know there's one in Oslo. Have you noticed what has been the slogans of those big demonstrations this year? In Toronto, in July, there was a big demonstration of 20,000 people. What was the slogan of that? Jobs and justice. The 28th of March, November in Norway has two main items: climate jobs, climate justice. In the last year, all religious leaders of the planet, the Pope, Muslim clerics, Dalai Lama, and only 3 days ago, 154 religious leaders across the world made a common statement saying that we need to put the globe below 2% degrees. Not 2.7, not 2.9, between 1.5 and 2 degrees. Only in France on Thursday, I think there was 100 media stories on that declaration by the clerics from across the world. The International Trade Union Confederation, which I mentioned, Sharon Barrow has written a chapter, they have hosted a conference in the middle of September with the French foreign minister in Paris. 200 delegates, unionists from across the world. I don't know if there were people from Finland. I know there were people from both Sweden and Denmark and Norway. And the idea of climate jobs is coming up there. It's not official yet, but there's a kind of a, how can I put it? I have a certain hope that I'll be able to speak on the official World of Work Pavilion of the International Trade Union Confederation in Paris on the 3rd and the 4th of December this year. Because I think that the idea of climate jobs, only last week there was a, you know, beginning in Portugal of a similar campaign, it has been picking up steam and it's being half recognized as something that is very important, even of the most important trade union confederation existing. So I think what Naomi Klein wrote in her late last book, the last chapter, how many of you have read Naomi Klein's book? I'm not asking as a kind of teacher thing, but just out of curiosity. Well, there's a couple of people. Well, the last chapter, how does it end? It ends by a climate modeler going through the different possibilities of averting the worst possibilities of climate change. And that model says that the only geophysical force that can change things soon enough is mass movements. Mass movements. And with those clerics, with the International Trade Union Confederation, with those 300,000 and 400,000 people demonstrating in New York last year, and with the upcoming things now, I think we have to place our ideas within that growing movement. And I want to end, because we're going to have a discussion, by saying that, well, all of this is very grand, and I think it can be even bigger. I think that when that idea catches up, when people go on strike for jobs and for the planet at the same time, when they start occupying factories for jobs and for the planet for the same time, and when we get the first victories out of this movement, these slogans of jobs, of justice that we've seen in Toronto, that we're going to see in Paris coming up now, you know, it will light a fuse and it'll inspire people everywhere. But those grand things start with individuals. There's a Swedish researcher called Nora Ratzel who has actually a research project on this. She has gone through where have trade unions started to pick up the question of climate change, from Spain to other countries. And it's often singular shop stewards, single representatives approached by either academics or by leftist people, coming, talking, how can we do something? How can we start something here? And they've started to roll the ball. Because let's face it, many trade unions across the world, I bet in Finland as well, feel that they have their backs against the wall and they have enough fighting for their pensions, for their salaries, for the kind of regular stuff that trade unions do. But in this day and age, I think there's a possibility that you can get some trade unions aboard. And if you can build the beginnings of alliances like that we've had with the Bridge to the Future Alliance in Norway, I think we can start to make powerful arguments seem like they have power. And when they do seem to have power, we will feel less depressed. We will be less kind of, you know, organizing our own denial in our head about what's going on, because we see there is something that I can do as part of a collective to make sure that this planet is habitable and a good place to be for generations and generations and generations and generations to come.